And welcome to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. I am so excited because, guys, hey, you know how, like, oftentimes we have, we wait till January to make those big decisions. Some people call them resolutions. And we say, we're going to eat better and we're going to save our money in a different way and we're going to exercise, right? I managed to do that in August. And I've managed to stick with it. And so I'm quite proud of myself. I've been going and keeping fit at least twice a week through the novelty of our community centers. These things that are like highly accessible to all members of our community. And I've been feeling really good about myself and feel no need to have any kind of like, I don't know, post New Year's ritualistic digging in of a resolution, declaring a resolution at the 1st of January or the 2nd of January and things like that. Because, hey, I'm an atheist and we can decide when our own rituals and holidays and things start. Thanks for joining me today, Josh and Dan. How are you, Josh?
I'm doing pretty good.
And Dan, what about you?
I'm doing great. Congratulations on reaching your goals.
Yeah. It's sort of like I have not reached my goal. I am continuing this commitment that I made.
Congratulations on pursuing your goals.
Yeah, but I gotta say that I am 99.99% certain that I will not be participating in any marathons. Running is just not my thing. Do you guys like the running deal?
No, not a
jogger.
I hate it with a passion because Every time I have to unload.
Okay. All right. And what about you, Dan?
Like other marine mammals, I'm a really out of my element with speed on land. Okay. It's just not my way.
Oh, so fellow swimmer.
Okay.
All right. Mm-hmm. But I suppose hiking and traipsing through the woods is also a thing that you might enjoy, right?
Yeah, that's different. It's not really about speed. In fact, for me, it's mostly about food acquisition. I like to forage as I hike. So.
Okay. Nice. What about you, Josh? What do you tend to like?
Hiking's pretty fun, but I also do cycling. I'm trying to lose a little bit of weight. I'm not succeeding, but at least I got a regular weekly cycling class I go to, then I'm going to double down if I really want to meet any goals.
Well, that's different from a gentleman in Savannah, Georgia, along with several other thousand people that were running a marathon or a 5K or a 10K or something like that. So a man who is revealed to have been a church volunteer has stepped back from the role and is facing sexual battery charges in the wake of having smacked the bottom of a reporter on live TV as he participated in a Savannah, Georgia marathon. Tommy Calloway, father of two and former teen volunteer at the Pittman Park United Methodist Church in Georgia, said he, quote, got caught up in the moment and had a misjudge in character and decision making when he touched the reporter's backside as he was getting ready to bring his hands up and wave to the camera. Calloway reportedly told station staff at WSAV that it was an awful act and an awful mistake, and said he is not the person that people are portraying him to be. Correspondent Alex Bazarjan has declined to accept phone calls from Calloway at her place of business, stated she is taking her time on whether to accept his apology, and has meanwhile filed a police report of the incident. Calloway has also been banned for life from participating in events sponsored by the Savannah Sports Council. So, friends, what do we think of Mr. Calloway?
Sorry.
you're both itching to give your opinions on this
certainly
guy.
Certainly sounds like a good youth leader.
There's sort of this long history of people, especially if you work with kids at a church, having like this dark and terrible secret. And this is probably the least dark and terrible secret that I've heard, like, coming to
the news. Well, not
very
secret if you do it on...
Well, no, it's not very secret, no.
National TV, or live TV, at least.
That being said, you don't get to invade somebody's bodily autonomy, no matter how caught up in the moment you are. You don't just go cruising by and smack somebody on the butt because you feel like it. That's not okay.
What do you guys make of this? This is not the person who I'm being made out to be.
What about having their back turned to you? It informs consent to this groping. I mean, really.
But when you say, you know, well, I didn't know, I didn't see her face, is the assumption that it's going to be okay when you, as a member of your church, whether you're a volunteer or an employee, you are someone that has some kind of authority and some kind of, I don't know, moral authority or leadership or something like that with teens? Is the assumption, is the default, you know, line here that it's okay to, as you said, invade someone's bodily autonomy? Where should that initial assumption be? It seems to be that, you know, you ask before you touch someone, especially in areas that are generally considered intimate.
Right. And if you don't grok that, don't work with kids or anybody for that matter. Don't go outside.
Certainly don't run in a public marathon. I don't know.
The thing to me that's really astounding about all of it is, like, the event itself is just captured on camera. And so there's no, like, oh, it was a mistake, it was an accident, I was reaching up to put my hands up to wave at the camera. No, you were doing no such thing. And everybody saw it. It's on film.
And that was the entire reason why he decided to do it, too. He saw the camera there.
Yeah.
He was not in denial of what the circumstance was at all at that point.
No, and there are plenty of other runners that are jumping in front of the camera to wave and say, woo, and, you know, hi, mom, and all those kinds of things. So it's not like you can accidentally smack grab someone when you were actually just trying to wave and say hi, mom.
Everybody else seemed to get it.
I hope that there can be an authentic apology that's offered, and that in the wake of an apology, you don't just get to say, well, my apology should excuse things. When you have behavior that can be registered as criminal, like, an apology doesn't necessarily excuse you from that kind of thing. It can go alongside any kind of criminal consequences or civil consequences that would happen from your actions. And the apology should be incidental to that, right? I think that he should offer an apology that's a little bit more than, I was caught up in the moment, right, and that's not really who I am. You know, how about that was wrong. I'm not going to be working with kids anymore. I'm ashamed that I have to face my own kids who I wouldn't want to experience this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I will not do this. Maybe that kind of apology. And then maybe not be in public, you know, communal life in a position of leadership and face your consequences, whether the criminal charges or any civil charges are actually brought against you.
Right. I don't think that it's wrong to seek redemption when you've done something very wrong, but you need to be on that path before an apology is even valid.
Yeah, you don't get to assume that you deserve it.
Right.
Well, going from something far away in the southeast corner of our country, back local. Last week, a thief burglarized the convent chapel of Tacoma's Holy Rosary Catholic Church, stealing the tabernacle, a sacred 20-inch brass box where the Eucharist is kept when not being used in services and rituals. Police reports indicate that a thief entered through the convent's kitchen door, which had not been fully latched. The tabernacle had been in use since the auxiliary convent chapel was built in the 1950s. The thief would have had to have unbolted it from its fixed location. Congregants and the greater Tacoma community at large are currently raising funds in an attempt to restore Holy Rosary's main church, an iconic neo-Gothic structure set for demolition after years of neglect. So we've talked about Holy Rosary Church. It's a cool building. The diocese has said, hey, you know what? It needs to be up to the individual congregations to raise the money because the Catholic Church as a whole isn't going to help you fund your buildings. We've talked about that might be a little bit messed up given how much money the Catholic Church could be sitting on.
Seems sort of hypocritical. It's like making your employees pay for their own uniform.
Or making your teachers pay for their own school supplies. I have interface with that or anything like that. So, but we've talked about the Holy Rosary Church and whether it, you know, quote unquote, deserves to be maintained as an architectural feature of Tacoma. There's an argument to be made there. That's really cool. But regardless of all of those things, don't go into churches and steal things. Like, this is something that's very important to the identity of individuals that have chosen a particular path in life. I don't agree with that path in life. It's not something I would choose for myself because, well, you know, I'm not a Catholic nun. But lay off and don't go stealing stuff from the convent. That just seems really rotten. And I, as an atheist, am confident in saying that with certainty. Josh, what do you think? Are you okay with the burglary? I'm putting you on the spot here.
Well, I'm just wondering how much this, why this brass box? Is it just like a nice one somebody wants to keep? Because it'd be really hard to sell because, I mean, everybody's going to be looking out for it. So what's your thought process? But also, yeah, don't do this. I mean, don't steal, period, basically, is what it comes down to. It happened in a church, but other than that, I don't think there's too much more to be said about that. It doesn't seem like this was targeted based on anything that was anti-Christian or anything like that. So it was just,
Yeah, just, no, there's no vandalism of anything else. There's nothing else that was stolen. I don't think that it's going for the big metal thing that you hope to have for scrappers.
Well, just brass, took a lot of, yeah. This took a lot of effort, though. It was bolted down. So, I mean, they had to plan ahead to bring a wrench with them. So that makes me think that somebody was there. It's somebody that cased the place and for some reason thought that this thing was worth taking.
I'm thinking it's maybe a Dan Brown type of conspiracy.
Oh, so there's a map hidden in it. And
yeah, there's like a secret compartment, and there'll be some kind of conspiracy that's been, I don't know, perpetrated on the Catholic community of Tacoma. No, I don't think that at all. Dan,
I'm just pleased to finally know what a tabernacle is.
Yeah,
I've been wondering about that word since I watched like the Mormon Tabernacle Choir with my folks one Christmas and was like, what is tabernacle? It's such a big, complicated, weird-sounding word. And now I know what a tabernacle is, but I don't think Mormons take communion. So now I'm a little bit more confused about the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
Well, a tabernacle, isn't that like the tent that you worship in normally?
Yeah, it can really change. It etymologically means a dwelling place. And so in a Catholic church, a tabernacle is the dwelling place of the Eucharist.
Oh, where the body of Christ lies down. Got it.
Yeah. And so for in a Jewish context, the tabernacle is where the scrolls were housed. That's where the Torah is housed. And it's sort of like in the ark, in the tabernacle. And you refer to it in biblical terms when, you know, you're sort of like carrying around the tabernacle as you're wandering through the desert before you can establish your own homeland in the, you know, land of Israel. And that's what I grew up knowing as the tabernacle. Oh. So truthfully, when I saw this, I said, well, there's a tabernacle in Catholic churches too. Okay, that's kind of interesting. But yeah, there's all kinds of, you know, holy and sacred objects that we as atheists might, you know, bestow no alternate meaning to other than the fact that this is a brass box that someone thinks is special. I don't think there's any magical powers to blood and body of Christ. I don't think there's any magical powers to a chalice filled with wine and a tasteless cracker.
I mean, it gets you drunk.
But so this is for the Eucharist. So this is so that they want to make their own crackers, throw their own crackers in them and use them for communion.
It's not an oven. It's not like a little easy bake.
That's just where you put them.
Well, yeah, but like it makes them holy, apparently.
Well, yeah, because, you know,
were they not holy before you put them in the tabernacle?
Well, there's like, so they have to be made, and then they have to be made holy somehow. So I'm just sure, like, I'm just assuming, like, the bishop will, like, pray over them, whatever, spray holy water, throw them in the tabernacle, and then start handing them out during communion.
This seems like a place to cut out the middleman. You could have somebody at the factory where the wafers are made, just making them holy as they leave.
Well, that's how the koshering process goes in for you know, dietary acceptable Jewish foods.
Efficiency.
And, you know, you can do lots of deep dives into the actual oversight that the rabbi who happens to be offering the blessings is actually doing. There's a whole can of worms. Well, not worms because they're not kosher. I don't know. Whole can of grasshoppers.
Locusts.
A whole locusts, can of right? locusts, right? That you can unearth and have them springing out in all different directions to see what is the actual benefit and oversight of koshering. But the bottom line is, just because we don't believe in these things doesn't mean that we want to wreck other people's holy objects, places of worship, places where, you know what, it isn't involved in any kind of government functions. It's not hurting us as individuals. And yeah, lay off, I guess, the Eucharist, lay off the tabernacle a little bit. Find your own place to dwell and don't invade the convent of the Holy Rosary.
Just eat crackers in bed like the rest of us.
You're listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. You got me, Becky Friedman, along with Josh and Dan. I may have referenced at some point over the last 10 years that I come from Jewish heritage, though I may not be a believer in God and supernatural things at this time. I guess this is still important to me, and especially because in the United States, you have a huge facet of being of Jewish heritage that isn't involved in religious belief, even for those that maybe attend temple and synagogue, but is more cultural than anything. I think, Josh, you brought this to my attention.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of came up about 2 weeks ago or so, but YouTube has suspended the far-right Christian channel True News for 1 week after their founder warned that the movement to impeach Donald Trump was a Jewish plot to stage a coup d'etat. Rick Wiles, an evangelical pastor based out of Flowing Streams Church in Vero Beach, Florida, has been banned or suspended in the past from social media, including YouTube, for espousing racist and anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. In the sermon at issue most recently, Wiles stated that the U.S. was on a path to enter civil war by Christmas time. He added his alarm at an impending purge where Jews will kill millions of Christians as they take over the country. Despite being shunned by many mainstream and social media outlets, True News has retained its White House press pass. Guys, I had a first thought here when I looked at the purge. Projection much? Yeah, I don't think that it was the Christians that were on the receiving end of Jewish individuals wanting to purge you from existence and killing millions of Christians. I think that there's a very specific number, somewhere around 6 million or so, and it wasn't Christians that were trying to be purged, right? Like, oh yay, 72 years ago or so, you know? Referencing the Holocaust, guys.
Yeah, no, we get it.
Yeah. And I highly recommend anybody that hasn't seen the video, just check out that, just because in about a 1 minute segment, he says Jew coup four times. He's not mincing words whatsoever in what he's intending behind his message. And this guy still retain, like, he's gotten news service has a White House press pass, and they're still giving that to him. So this guy actually has influence and actually reports directly from the White House. That's a prestige level that he should absolutely not have. And YouTube suspension for only a week.
Hopefully YouTube will, I think, do the right thing and cut this guy off at the knees, where he doesn't need to have a wider platform to be spreading these kinds of things.
I would like to see some sort of ramifications for the idea of spreading things that are demonstrably false. But I realize that also sort of tramples on First Amendment rights to free speech. Don't mistake me. I am by no means going down the freedom of speech. You know, you blocked me on Facebook. What about the First Amendment? No. What I would like to see is agencies that have a press pass or that have some sort of responsibility to the public to report news accurately. I would like to see that when they fail at this, particularly deliberately, that there is some sort of ramification, that their press pass is revoked or a fine is laid down. But again, that sort of borders on the sort of First Amendment stuff. So,
yeah, when you're talking about dealing directly with a government institution such as the White House,
right.
But there is an upper limit to that. And I don't think saying basically putting out a conspiracy about Jewish conspiracy to take over the government should be covered by that.
Now, in terms of looking at demonstrably false assertions that are put forth in something that is purported to be journalistic, we've got, though, the president of the United States saying that when something literally is demonstrably false, saying, oh, people who are calling out its falsehood, that's fake news. So that's one of those really, really bizarre things that I am still trying to wrap my head around, especially as an educator who has spent 15 years helping high schoolers and middle schoolers evaluate sources. You know, part of their biggest things when they're writing an informative or a persuasive essay is to have some kind of bibliography or works cited. And we talk about how to evaluate those sources. And we spent so long saying if it's .gov, that's a reliable source. You know, where those kinds of things are putting me as an educator in a very awkward and new situation.
All right, we're entering a part of our timeline here where Wikipedia is more accurate than government websites. And this is troubling.
Yeah.
Extremely troubling.
The really cool thing about Wikipedia is that there really are very, very stringent protocols for what gets included, what gets, you know, flagged as needing citation or having bias. And so even just on a Wikipedia article where something at the top says this article may have bias in it, just that thing right at the top, alerting a reader to that is huge. And I think that it's really cool. Listeners of Ask an Atheist can go back into our episode archive at atheist.radio, where we talked with the guerrilla skeptics of Wikipedia, who are looking to ensure that those kinds of articles and that kind of information is as accurate and complete as possible, because Wikipedia is one of the most used sources and websites in the world. I'm glad to see that in schools we're now looking at this is what Wikipedia actually is, as opposed to just saying you can't use Wikipedia as a source because anybody can edit it and anybody can say anything they want.
Right. That's not exactly true. The Wikipedia of today is not the moon is built by beavers Wikipedia of 2003. Right.
Exactly.
So we are now at the point where if you cite a government website, you might have to cite another source.
I think based on just the things that we've covered in the last 3 years, where you'll have a State Department website that talks about how to be a Christian leader in executing your job functions, then yes, there is purpose enough and there is founding enough to be skeptical of those kinds of things when they're presented, to see not just the whether they're factual, but the completeness of them, the angle that's being taken on government websites, the propaganda that is being portrayed on, you know, different things that's published on anything with a .gov top level domain. It's worrying and alarming when we see something from our ostensibly secular government saying this is how you should be a Christian leader. Digging a little bit deeper into things having to do with Judaism and with government, Donald Trump signed an executive order to fight what he calls anti-Semitism on college campuses by interpreting Jewishness as a nationality in cases related to Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. The order allows his administration to withhold federal funding from universities who do not consider student protest movements critical of Israel as discriminatory. Title VI prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, and national origin in programs and activities receiving federal financial assistance. In spite of religion not being specifically mentioned in that section of the law, Muslim, Hindu, and Sikh students have been protected from discrimination under Title VI based on their shared ancestry or ethnic characteristics. Critics of the order posit that the order was intentionally designed to chill free speech critical of the Israeli state, and argue that it takes away the right of identity self-determination for Jewish students and employees on campus.
I don't see how this is a good thing in any way. One thing that I hear about how Jews are addressed in the news all the time is about dual loyalty, basically, because they're assumed to have loyalty to Israel as well as the U.S. And so that actually is a charge that's hammered against Jews all the time. And this kind of reinforces that.
I think it does, too. It feels like a very dangerous slippery slope, which within logical functions is a fallacy. But within legal functions, slippery slope leads to perhaps unintended consequences. When I'm looking at a president who decries globalism and celebrates nationalism and then says Jewishness is a nationality, for someone that's a zealotist anti-globalist, suddenly having Judaism as a nationality or Jewishness as a nationality will put into question my Americanness through right. no action of my own. And if I happen to be on a college campus, if I'm taking a class and I am participating in, I don't know, a chartered student club that is critical of Israeli policies, maybe saying, you know, end Palestinian apartheid. That's something that's a very frequent call to action on college campuses. Then unless the college that I am attending calls me an anti-Semite, they risk losing federal funding. That's what I mean by threatening the right to self-identity and self-determination as a Jewish individual. When you're saying that merely criticizing the state of Israel makes you an anti-Semite, where does that put a whole bunch of progressive Jews? This is really dangerous, creepy stuff. And meanwhile, you have individuals that are, you know, representatives of very important and very high profile Jewish groups applauding this kind of thing, saying, yes, we do need to address increasing anti-Semitism on college campuses. Well, increasing anti-Semitism on college campuses is the kind of thing where you have, I don't know, like swastikas put on the Hillel building, right? Increasing anti-Semitism on college campuses is where the kid who happens to be walking across the square wearing a yarmulke has eggs thrown at him. That's what I look at as increasing anti-Semitism. When you have student movements that are saying boycott, divest, and have sanctions against Israel, or let's have our own campus not be involved in supporting and upholding what we believe to be apartheid, that is now, according to Donald Trump, anti-Semitism. And this is something that for me is very chilling and puts me on sort of this definitely puts me on edge.
Yeah, and this actually has First Amendment problems. So basically this is an issue with the First Amendment because it is trying to use the government to suppress speech. And the Republicans have been arguing for years that money is speech and the ability to divest should also be considered an act of speech. So even if you don't like the BDS movement, I personally don't know where I'm at on that. There are legitimate criticisms that they have, and it's the same. It's using the same tactics that was used against apartheid.
Against South African apartheid in the 80s, right? So what I'm wondering here is when we look at this from a perspective of criticizing Israel, well, is any kind of criticism of a foreign government suddenly subject to discrimination restrictions? So, you know, if I happen to be on campus and I want to protest the Chinese government, am I now putting my institution at risk of having their federal funding yanked because I'm being discriminatory towards an entire nation? This takes away the entire right to protest.
Even this nation.
Certainly. Right.
And why are Catholics then not considered dual citizen at that point? Like, why aren't they their own nationality there? I mean, because Catholicism all follows the Vatican, which is a country all on its own.
Oh, that would be a good point. I guess when we see a rising anti-Catholicism on college campuses, we might have that as well.
And that existed. I mean, there was a time when Protestants and Catholics, surprise, surprise, don't get along, or at least for a long time, didn't get along. Them getting actually working together is a new phenomenon.
I saw this as being linked to what's going on in India right now, where India has passed a bill that would exclude Muslim immigrants from obtaining citizenship while fast-tracking Hindus and religious minorities from Afghanistan, Bangladesh, and Pakistan. The ruling Hindu Nationalist Party has argued that the bill aims to give refuge and citizenship to religious minority immigrants that fled persecution in their home countries as long ago as 1971, with Prime Minister Narendra Modi contending that Muslims in the three neighboring countries are not religious minorities and therefore do not need India's protection. Critics argue that the bill contravenes India's secular constitution and is not grounded in protecting minorities, since minority Muslim sects such as Ahmadis in Pakistan are not eligible for Indian citizenship despite facing persecution in their country of origin. Protests have erupted in cities across Bengal and Assam states, as well as in the capital of New Delhi. Bengali Chief Minister Mamata Banerjee has called for continued resistance rallies and said she will not implement it if the law is signed by India's president. This kind of religious test for citizenship is very chilling to me. It's very alarming to me.
And it's becoming a common thread.
When we see that common thread where we have Trump being zealously anti-globalist, and when you have Modi's party, Hindu nationalists, pushing this Hindutva, that sort of Hindu nationalism, that linking Indianness inextricably with Hindu adherence and not to any other particular minority faith, these are the things that are quite creepy to me. And I couldn't help but see these two things as linked. And, you know, on one hand, when you say if you're a Hindu or a Christian or a Jain and you happen to have fled Pakistan in, I don't know, 1979, and your family's been living in India, we want to welcome you and give you citizenship. That seems like a great thing. That seems like a beautiful thing because you've been living here. You've been provided the opportunity to have to be able to practice your faith, you know, unencumbered. But using that as a proxy to exclude Muslims to the advantage of Hindu nationalism is something that I just am very worried by. And I'm seeing these kinds of two things reflected, you know, home side for us in the United States. And then in India, you've got two hugely powerful nations, India being one of the most populous nations, you know, sort of on these trends. And it's something that worries me.
And not to forget also Kashmir, which is between India and Pakistan, is being highly, highly militarized. It basically, they India has subverted the entire government that existed in Kashmir, and right now is going under a lot of problems. And this is just going to add on to that, because there is a lot of Muslims in Kashmir that are suffering under under these new rules.
It are all these things, are those things that worry us as atheists, as pluralists, as secularists, as humanists. You're listening to Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. We'll be back after the break.
Welcome back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. That's our voicemail, toll-free nationwide. And greetings from Tokyo, which is the oh, man. How do I explain this? And joining me is Dan and Josh, but you knew that, right?
We've been here the whole time.
Yeah, we're all on the... I haven't. I'm sitting down. Hi, I'm your sub today, so we're just going to order pizza and watch the Goonies, if that's okay with you.
Yes!
Anyway, yeah, so there are certain things that you are assumed to like because you are a nerd. Or you are perceived to be a nerd. I'm not a nerd, I'm a geek. But, if that means anything, I've always found the speciation in these categories kind of dubious, if you will. But you guys, I mean, you're a computer guy, Josh. You're a fish guy. You're a merman.
That's what I am. Yeah.
Yeah. You're Ethel Merman.
There's a weird assumption I get all the time that, like,
right,
because I like cephalopods, right? I'm interested in octopus and squid. People keep buying me Cthulhu stuff, and I'm like, I've never even read it. I have only the most casual familiarity with it. Stop buying me HP Lovecraft stuff.
So that's exactly it. Like, you know, over the years, it, you know, starting out as a IT guy, and when I was a teenager, everybody just assumed that I liked Dilbert. And I thought, you know, okay, now no one likes Dilbert, because it turns out Scott Adams is very much a yutz and a horrible human being. Uh-huh. But it was always, oh, yeah, here's a Dilbert candy dispenser or whatever, because you're clearly that guy. And then one of my favorite things is, okay, not favorite, kind of the opposite of favorite, if I'm really being honest, is when for this 1 week that I had this Willamette company doing my dentistry, the company that nearly killed me, by the way. The one that sent me to the hospital. I have no problem telling you that. They nearly killed me. They nearly exploded my face in 2012.
Wow.
And so I'm leaning back, and they're like, so what do you do? I was like, I do computers. I'm like, oh, you're kind of a geek, like, oh, or a nerd. Oh, I guess so. And the dentist goes, well, I'm going to talk about Big Bang Theory, the entire freaking procedure.
No.
And you can't do anything about it, because the only way you can voice your protestations, it doesn't work that well. And now, in modern times, it is something a lot less annoying, but it's XKCD. People will just unsolicited send me XKCD comics because, oh, we feel that you identify with this because blah, blah, blah. Of the things that I have been forced to like, and I include IT Crowd in this, I'm not a huge fan of the show, even though Iowate is amazing, is XKCD is by far the least problematic for me. And one of my, I have two favorite comics from that. One is the Pass the Horse battery staple thing. When people ask me what a good password is, I send them that now.
Right.
Because it's a great explanation. The other one is when you have no circadian rhythm, which I have never had a circadian rhythm, you greet the person with whatever time zone you're waking up in where it would be morning.
Huh.
And so when I woke up today, I was in Tokyo.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So greetings from Tokyo. It's December. It's I don't know how to explain it, but
the sun was already gone by the time you woke up.
Yeah, the sun was already gone by the time I like the sun is only out for like 4 hours a day, and the sunlight you get is this thin gruel. It's like eating. It's like all you have is like a quarter of a bag of instant oatmeal. And in order to like make up the difference in mass in your stomach, you add more water. I don't know. Have you been?
No.
Are you with me?
I think we get what you're going. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's what the sunlight is like. Is and it just for somebody who just has no real good concept of circadian rhythm in their brain. In November and December, I just have nothing that even comes close to a real sleep schedule.
You know, based on last week's episode, I think I have a suggestion for you.
What's that?
Have you tried sunning your taint in the diluted gruel?
I mean,
yeah, actually, so if you notice around the house, I do have sun lamps. I have a lot of them. Maybe I just haven't been turning them on.
Right.
Like, maybe I need to flip one on and shove it down my pants and see what happens.
I need you to squat over a mirror and just learn to be happy.
Josh Brolin would suggest you not do this. Yeah. He kind of burned his own.
Can you imagine Becky comes home from school? I had such a wholesome day teaching people how to better interface with their students. Sam, what the heck are you doing? Making sure I get enough
vitamin D.
I'm learning to love me for me. I thought that was part of education.
Sam, are you finally trying to have sex with electricity? No, no, that's not it at all. I'm not cheating on you with the physical force. It's a medical.
It's not what it looks like.
Yeah, it's not what it looks like.
It's what it looks like. It's what it looks like.
No, this is exactly what it looks like. so that's... I should try that, I guess. No, I shouldn't. but what should I listen to while I'm having my...
Well, we have a suggestion.
Yeah, what is it?
There's this great... I guess it's a sequel, a part two to Snoopy versus the Red Baron.
Oh, you went to the wrong thing. I was going to end on the email. I was going to suggest that I was hoping you go to Fish Grunts because that's why you're here today.
Yeah, no, we could definitely listen to some Fish Grunts. My immediate suggestion for what you should listen to while sunning your perimenium, though, would be Tainted Love.
Now, which version? You know, the Marilyn Manson version?
It doesn't matter.
Both at the same time.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Ears, yeah.
One in each ear. Yeah.
No. Three. The original, the Marilyn Manson one, and then the Coneheads one from the movie No One Saw.
Oh, man. I forgot that even existed. I remember something about killing a monster with golf.
Yes.
That's about all
he sings Tainted Love while he's doing it.
Classic Coneheads.
Yeah, that movie was not good.
Where are we going for real, though? Fish Grunts?
We were going to Fish Grunts. Oh, yeah, because in the callback, the thing that melted my brain last week was the idea of people with their pants off, you know, face down, other end up, listening to Fish Grunts. I don't know why, but that just sort of melted my brain. it was a news story I saw that day, which I thought was kind of a culmination of two things we often talk about on the show, which is the health of the seas, Prince Namor, and audio, which is, you know, so that's like a great combination of the two things. So I was like, oh, we should talk about this, you know, and then, are you familiar with this news story now, or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting information. There was a study that came out in 2010 that predates this one by quite a long time that showed that playing the sounds of a healthy coral reef caused coral larval stages, so before they're even a polyp, caused them to settle in an area better than alternative areas where they were not playing those sounds. And the cool thing about that was that this was 2010. This was the first evidence that we had from any sort of a scientific research to show that cnidarians, that is to say jellies, corals, hydroids, things like that, actually have a sense of hearing. So this was a brand new thing for you know, the thousands and thousands of years that we've known about jellies and anemones and corals. And only in 2010 do we find out that they can hear. Not only do they hear, but they can differentiate between the sounds of a healthy reef and a not healthy reef, and they'll preferentially settle in one place.
I kind of wonder where. So I'm not real clear on the evolutionary relationships between these creatures, but where does squid fit on this?
not.
Okay, good. Yeah.
They're a separate phylum.
They're completely separate phylum.
Squid are mollusks along with octopuses and clams.
They can hear, but it's more of a pressure sense, isn't it?
Well, all hearing is a pressure
sense. But I mean, like, it's more, we have ears.
Mm-hmm.
But cnidarians and certain other sea creatures we didn't think heard don't. So is it kind of a whole body pressure sense, or do we know the neurological, how the wiring is set up there?
We might, but I'll come out and say I do not personally.
Okay.
Now I've got a new thing to research.
Oh, right on. Okay.
I can tell you with how it works in a lot of vertebrates, that fish have lateral lines. Fish also have ears. Their lateral lines allow them to hear low frequency vibrations with extreme directionality. Their ears, so to speak, their otoliths inside their skulls, are also sensing vibrations. But most animals really can't hear high-frequency noises, which is sort of a neat thing. If you're talking about reptiles, if you're talking about fish, you're talking about animals that can't hear a high-pitched noise. Birds and mammals are kind of outliers in that respect. We're very sensitive to high-pitched noises. But there's a lot of sort of behavioral research that's come out of that as far as different populations of animals making different frequencies of noises and why. But I've digressed way off the point. So... anyhow, playing the sound in a damaged, well, in a mock-up of a damaged coral reef where they've just taken dead coral and sort of piled it up about 27 meters away from a healthy part of the reef,
mm-hmm.
brought in more juvenile fish, a more diverse group of them. They hung out longer. So there's a good thing there that we know that playing these sounds can recruit corals to an area. And then this most recent study has shown that you can also recruit the rest of the biome, having a lot of the fish species come and show up too.
Mm-hmm.
And since they're all sort of interconnected and dependent on each other, I mean, you couldn't just have one.
Right.
You need them both. The concern there is that this isn't something that can save a reef.
No.
Period. If you bring in fish to a reef that is not producing, those fish will leave or those fish will die. And the fish being there isn't enough to turn a dead reef into a live one. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more that goes on. Corals are... part of the lowest levels of the production chain in their ecosystem. So most of the energy from the sun that is being brought into their ecosystem is brought in by phytoplankton. It's brought in by marine algae, but a lot of it's also brought in by these little organisms that live inside the coral's bodies called zooxanthellae. They are similar to an algae. They produce sugars and feed it to the coral. This is the reason that corals have so many different bright colors, the reason that they're UV responsive. It's all about harboring and protecting these zooxanthellae. And the zooxanthellae are the ones that have these beautiful colored pigments. When the water becomes too warm or too acidic, these zooxanthellae start to produce toxic compounds, which causes their coral hosts to eject them.
Right.
So the toxins don't build up and they die. So if we're trying to save a coral reef, we're going to have to adapt corals to higher temperatures and higher acidity, which is the thing that's going on and in fact being propagated. We're also going to have to do something about the accelerating rates of temperature and acidity in the ocean. If we don't adjust that first, there's nothing that we can do that's going to keep up with it. But when we're trying to rebuild a reef with, say, corals that are more resilient to this kind of thing, if we're trying to get them to settle in an area, then that sound stuff actually becomes a very useful part of the plan.
That's just it. Five or so years ago, we interviewed Bill Nye back when he was still kind of on the fence about GMOs and stuff like that. And one of the ways I take some small credit in getting him to change his mind on that, because I think I helped get the ball rolling.
I don't think you're wrong.
Yeah, you know, because at the time he was going places and saying, we need to start thinking about our environment as something we have to engineer, as something that we have to take charge of, because we've damaged it enough that we're going to have to fix it if we want a stable biome, where this isn't a silver bullet because those things don't exist. I mean, you can make a bullet out of silver, but it's not going to do what you want. I think Cody's lab did the video on that. Couldn't find a werewolf, though, so whatever. But this sounds like a tool in the toolbox to repair a reef once conditions have stabilized.
Right.
And we're going to need a lot of tools like this if we're going to undo the damage that climate change is doing.
Absolutely.
Does that sound about right?
That's absolutely correct. And,
okay.
And I would compare it to, say, cancer research. The issue that I see here is really sort of reckless journalism.
Okay.
Where reporters will find out about this thing and be like, hey, it turns out that you can save a reef by playing this sound. And everybody goes, oh, I guess we don't have to worry about the reefs anymore. Along the same lines as seeing a study where it's, you know, Australian scientists have cured cancer. Well, in a certain type of neuron in mice brains in 70% of participants on this very one specific pathway of one type of cancer. Mm. That's the only part where I take issue with stories like this sort of getting as widespread as they are. It's like, well, when you tell people that we've already won, it sort of fosters inaction.
This could be a story for another day. But I think like on this one, it's real common for people who follow science to sort of put journalists on the pinata string and hit them with a pole. And I don't think this is entirely the fault of journalism. I think there's I think there's an actual buy-in by science and people who do research that also play into the problem. I think this is I think this is a lot more global. I think there's the need for funding. Mm-hmm. There's the need for attention. There's the pressures of publish or perish, which we like to pretend aren't real pressures, but they're there. And
oh, yeah,
they're real.
Absolutely.
And they are worse than they are ever been than they've ever been as we try to commodify the concept of secondary and tertiary education. You know, like I said, we could talk about this. Like, I understand science doesn't get it right, but that's also that's often when you have people who aren't scientists reporting on science, much like you have people who write movies about computers who don't know anything about computers. You get hackers in the net. That's, you know, it took 30 years for Mr. Robot to come out. And
what's the other one? War Games?
War Games. Oh, yeah. War Games is actually pretty good because there's very little computer stuff in it. I just always wanted that NORAD war room in my bedroom. That's always what I wanted. You know, like they said, we could talk about it some other day, but this is good news, but it's not like, I mean, it's not amazing news.
Right. It's good news. It's not a win. Mm-hmm. And it has some precedent in that, you know, it was done in 2010 with corals, which are arguably a more important component of restoring a coral reef. But it's good to know that this also works with a diverse populations of fishes.
All right.
So
cool. Yeah. See, I don't know if I like doing it this way because the buy-in and the payoff is pretty separated. But we mentioned the story last week and we're kind of adding the science to it this week, which is pretty neat. An American Airlines passenger was nearly kicked off her flight this fall during boarding because a crew member was offended by her T-shirt that read Hail Satan and featured a small upside down cross. Swati Rooney Goyal was traveling from her home in Key West, Florida to Las Vegas with her spouse when she was told to change or leave the aircraft. The couple initially refused to deboard, with Goyal retorting that she, as a foreign-born minority woman, understood what is offensive and contended her shirt was not. When further instructed by customer service agent, Goyal relented and covered her shirt with her husband's second layer and was allowed to remain on board, but noted the crew avoided eye contact with her and ignored her during refreshment service. Goyal's initial written inquiry to the airline resulted in an email from customer service stating that the company had policies in place to ensure that no passengers are subjected to objectionable situations while on board. After Goyal tweeted about her experience a month later, American Airlines apologized for her treatment, offered a refund for both tickets, and assured her that an investigation is ongoing.
Now I know how to fly free on American Airlines.
But why would you?
Yes, I'm not a fan of AA, but...
Well, is there an airline that isn't stupid at this point, now that there's only like six of them and and they all have a second kidney charge?
Yeah, no, they're getting pretty bad, and they're like trying to squeeze every possible inch they can so they can fit more seats in there. Now you could save money by wearing a Satan shirt.
Right. I found that for the ecological costs of flying, I would much rather just road trip it.
Yeah.
I know. If you're going a long ways, it's not very practical. You better have a lot of time on your hands. And there's a lot of people who need to fly in their lives, but I'm not one of them.
Okay. Well, that's fair. I've always liked aviation. And I liked flying until it became the world's worst application of security theater. And then I'm like, all right, well, this is, they've ruined this. You know, the federal government is paying somebody to look at my junk, which is something nobody should do. And if they grab me by the scrotum and I dance on it, I'm the one committing sexual assault.
How does that even work?
Because federal government. That's right. The answer. But this, I mean, what do you say to this? Like, what? Okay, yeah. Situation, you know, in what is it? Compromising situations or weird situations? This isn't a situation. It's a T-shirt. Don't read it.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's not even against anything. All it says is "Hail Satan."
Mm. Yeah, I mean, where's your religious freedom?
Right.
Yeah.
Seriously. I mean, honestly, they're not a federal agency, but still.
La la la. Well, really? They aren't?
I mean, they're named American, but...
Yeah. In an oligarchy, where does the corporation begin and the government end?
Right. Can you walk onto the same plane in a shirt that says, Praise Jesus?
Yeah, absolutely.
People do every freaking day.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not anti-anything. It's just, yeah. Here's the thing I like. Hail it. Here's the thing I like. Praise it. Whatever.
Look, that would be a great test. I'd like federal funding and, you know, from the NSF, and I'd like...
There isn't any anymore.
30 one-way tickets to any destination I choose, and I'm just going to wear t-shirts that say, hail something, and, you know, hail the NES, or hail chicken fried steak, and we'll see what happens and where that goes. My other question is... An investigation is ongoing, the corporate speak version of thoughts and prayers. What's to investigate?
I think it just might be.
Yeah, no.
You type three commands into your computer and you figure out who is on that flight, talk to them, figure out, like, this takes 10 minutes.
Right.
Like, this is a thing that can be figured out in one phone call, and then you've figured it out, and you're defending your policy. An investigation is ongoing is just thoughts and prayers. That doesn't mean anything.
Well, I mean... The happy ending, though, is they did get their money refunded.
They got their money refunded,
which is pretty sweet.
Is that better than living in a culture where you can't like things on a T-shirt?
No.
Okay.
No, that's...
All right. I mean, if all I have to do is buy a T-shirt from the Satanic Temple, and from now on I can fly for free on American Airlines because somebody's going to get on my case. All right, I'm okay with this. I'm okay with exploiting a bad system. I have no morals. Clearly, I'm an atheist. My preference would be that we live in a society where people can like different things, even if they're kind of silly, like the Satanic Temple.
Right. Or Jesus.
Or Jesus. But that's not silly. That's more dangerous.
Or barbecue sauce and pineapple on a pizza.
Hey.
No.
It's fine.
Pineapple on pizza, too, is fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I had some last night. It was great.
Right. We've all got our different definitions of what makes a pizza, and that's fine.
Yeah.
I contend that barbecue sauce is a line too far.
Well, why?
I don't know. I've tried it with chicken. It's pretty good with chicken, but it's just like, I don't know. My definition of a pizza is a marinara sauce, a tomato-based sauce.
But pizza isn't a dish. I mean, okay, in Europe, where pizza comes from, it's a very different thing and is very specific.
Right. Yeah, it's a flat bread with whatever topping you want.
It's bread, and sometimes not even bread, because now bread is bad. Yeah, so now we have pizza on...
You can have cauliflower.
I posit that cauliflower crust pizza actually qualifies as bread. It's just bread of a different kind. I've had cauliflower crust pizza that was great.
Huh.
Yeah. I mean, was it chewy? No, it was real crumbly, but it was good. It was, like, super well done. And, well, not, like, steak well done. It's not like somebody took a blowtorch to it. But, yeah. So, I mean, it's like the OSI model, which I'm referencing for the second time in a week. It's the way of doing things.
I was just going to say, I grew up watching Ninja Turtles.
Yeah.
Right? And so I have a very loose definition for pizza, because an everyday occurrence in my afternoon cartoon watching was like, hey, Roth, pass the anchovies and ice cream. And I just get my brain just sort of adjusted that, like, oh, yeah, pizza's whatever you want it to be. Pizza's like God.
Well, we've got the email that you referenced earlier, which we will now wrap up on. So this is Kim from New Zealand, who writes, I know you've been having a lot of conversations around Christmas songs. Here in New Zealand, we are obsessed with a track called Snoopy Christmas from an American band called The Royal Guardsmen. It was released in 1995, and many Kiwis consider hearing this song as the official start of Christmas. It even has a music video featuring Snoopy and Woodstock from the Peanuts comics. The weird thing is no one else in the world really knows this band, but ask a Kiwi and we love it. I admit I love this song, and I always shed a tear when I listen to it. Sappy, I know, but the message both warms my heart and disturbs me, and when you listen, remember it's the German guy who has the Christmas spirit, not our hero. I've enjoyed listening to you over the last 6 months since I discovered you via Radio versus the Martians. Merry Christmas to you, Becky, and the rest of the Ask an Atheist family from sunny New Zealand. Sam, kia kaha, stay strong in Maori, though the actual meaning is much deeper than that. We really like having you here. Wow. Thank you.
We like having you here too, Sam.
Okay. I hope I pronounced that correctly. I'm bad at, it's kind of a going joke that I'm bad at pronouncing things in other languages, on the show. And I hope I did that justice, but thank you very much, Kim, that, I read that when I woke up in Tokyo, and, it hit pretty hard. I'll admit. I'm familiar with the song. I've heard it. So there's some echoes of the World War One. Well, because Red Baron, you know,
right?
The World War One Christmas Armistice. I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, which is kind of confusing since the armistice was something that happened on the battlefield and not in the air.
Well, it's kind of hard to play soccer in the air soccer. Oh my God, that would be amazing. I mean, we already do air track and field here in Seattle. Why not air association football?
It's already the thing. It's Quidditch.
No, but like, I've seen Quidditch played on a field. It's super lame. I want planes. I want as much petroleum projects shooting in the atmosphere as possible.
We're going to have ourselves an armistice.
Hey, if we could do it with, I mean, you'd almost have to do it with gliders at that point.
Right.
Wouldn't you? Yeah. I mean, yikes. Otherwise, otherwise, instead of a death toll of tens, we're talking a death toll of hundreds. Right. It would be terrible. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for the Christmas wishes, even though I am the general of the war on Christmas. but that's always it. I play the general because I kind of hate the holidays, but I would never get in the way of somebody's desire to celebrate. And I never like get all in a, I don't go all Scrooge on you when somebody wishes me a Merry Christmas. So thank you for that.
There's just one thought I had thinking about the legendary Christmas Eve armistice.
Mm-hmm.
Where they stopped firing for like, what, 45 minutes or something like that? And they ended up playing soccer.
Mm.
In a minefield.
In a minefield. Yeah, like after they dragged all the bodies and broken chunks of bayonet and stuff off the field, they, you know, set up some goals and had a soccer game. Can you imagine being the guy that flops during that game?
And on that note, this is Ask an Atheist. Our website is atheist.radio. You can email us at questions@atheist.radio. Our voicemail is 844-753-7842. Our Twitter is Ask an Atheist WA. I talked about Vim a lot this week, the editor. Yeah. Thank you, Becky. Thank you, Josh.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Dan.
Always happy.
See you next week.